Good afternoon. It's Dan again on this Wednesday of this most auspicious year of 2019. It is January the 9th. And I'm doing, it's my second podcast today. Still looking for a job, still trying to figure out a way to make ends meet. And as a backup plan, still figuring out how much shit I can get rid of so I can live out of a old U.S. Army duffel bag. None of which fucking matters that much, in my opinion. It doesn't really matter. It doesn't have to matter to you. It really doesn't have to matter much to history. Back in late 2015, and this was about, a year and a half after my divorce, almost 2 years after my divorce, I was in a place where financially and economically, I was really secure. I had virtually no debt other than a relatively small student loan payment. And I actually had a lot of money saved up in the form of physical silver and some other items kept in my gun safe. And so if I looked at my life as a balance sheet, and said to myself, well, you've got no debt, you've got a good credit score. It was 777 at the time. If there's such a thing as a minus credit score, which I know that such things do not exist, my credit score today would be minus. But at the time it was, 777, which was considered okay, right? But with all of that sort of economic prosperity, if you want to call it that, I was kind of in an empty place. I didn't really believe, and again, this hasn't changed much for me since 2008. I didn't really believe in the Potemkin village economy. It all seemed like bullshit to me. So even if I was doing well, all I had to do, and I was in Indianapolis at the time, so all I had to do was go out to Washington Street, especially in the summer, and see the obvious signs of prostitution, a lot of which looked underage, and realized that, with the homeless encampment across the White River and what appears to be a smorgasbord of pay for pedophilia on Washington Street or Washington Avenue, whatever, to me, it seemed like bullshit. It seemed like a lie. Like whatever I was being told by the Obama administration about the greatest economy ever, the reality was it was bullshit. I've talked a lot about the economy and that topic, and I've discussed it today, so I don't want to go off on that. But one of the subjects that is relevant to this podcast is this issue of protected classes versus, I would say, accepted or promoted villains. And the great, if you listen to the quote-unquote intelligentsia, the globalist kind of quasi-neoliberal, sometimes socialist, but in general, the New World Order intelligentsia, people like me, specifically straight, white, male, middle-aged, should just go away. I mean, if they dug a giant hole someplace in the Midwest, they would load us up on trains and just dump us in the hole. And that may sound extreme, but if you look at the propaganda, especially from quote-unquote great sources of journalistic integrity and information like the New York Times or the Washington Post, you have people on their editorial boards, people who write their opinions, who more or less think that if you were born a white male and you're also straight, then not only are you guilty of great historical crimes, but you're kind of a terrible person. You ought to undergo some type of psychological retraining or re-education. And even then, you should be relegated to a second or third or, to use a variable, nth class status. All of which is, I shake my head because I'm already there. I'm already there. If you're looking for justice against the white man, you can at least be happy that there's at least one white straight male that is pretty much almost already there. in a few more weeks, it's really going to come down to how much bullshit I can put up with living on the sidewalks of Seattle. I've got a plan. I'm not going to go gently into that good night. My plan right now is to figure out how to live even lighter in terms of stuff than I have today. And it's not like I have much, but I've got to, like I said, I got to get down to a U.S. Army duffel bag. So it doesn't, you know, you really do have to ask some tough questions of what you take with you. But this whole subject has got me thinking about something, and that, you know, just full disclosure, a long time ago now, 20 years ago, actually 25 years ago almost, I was in graduate school studying history. I never got my PhD. I just have a shitty master's degree, and frankly, not from a school you would have ever heard of, so it's irrelevant. This is long before I ever got into computer programming. This was when I was actually in ROTC to what I was planning to do was to make the Army a career. I mean, a different life, different person. I believed a lot of different things back then. But back then in graduate school, we studied historiography. And one of the subjects of historiography, or I should say the formal study of history, is this tension between sort of evidence-based historical studies, which to some extent archaeology, anthropology, certain forms of anthropology, attempt what I would call the evidence-based historical analysis. And then you have historicism, which is where people take a theory, like Marxism, which frankly, Marxism and its many variants, okay, Marxism and to some extent late 20th century French critical theory, most specifically deconstruction, and some other feminist theories in sort of reevaluating the relationship between male and female power. These are the types of theories that have dominated historicism in academic historical research. And I'll add one other. I'll add endism by Fukuyama. Fukuyama's endism, which is basically the neoliberal, you know, historical justification for pretty much all the bullshit going on today. If the United States is bombing or blowing up a country, if the United States is toppling a government through CIA-sponsored NGOs in the Ukraine, it's because, according to Fukuyama, the liberal, democratic, the liberal democratic state is the end state of history. History has ended, and now it's just a matter of cleaning up the mess. I mean, that Fukuyama is terrible because people still believe his bullshit. But yes, historicism falls into a few slots now. Marxism and its many, many variants, which includes cultural Marxism. Postmodern and deconstructionist theories of history. That'd be number two. Number three is what I would call the victim theory historicist models, most primarily feminist. And then last but not least, the neoliberal Fukuyama type bullshit. Yes, there's more stuff out there. There's actually historicists who I think are on the right track, people who deal with energy, specifically issues of energy in terms of economics. So there are folks out there who are historicists, who do sort of live in the water of both evidence and general theory, who I would say are not off base, but they're definitely not the majority. Probably the majority is the neoliberal Fukuyama bullshit, despite all the chaos, despite all the insanity, despite all of the shit. And even as things get bad, even with Brexit and the yellow vest rioters in France, and all of the breakdowns in international trade, the neoliberal Fukuyama historicists are still out there and they're still standing strong. But I'm going to propose a general historicist model that I don't think is necessarily more accurate than all of the above I've just mentioned, except for I'd like to table issues of energy separately because I think that they're closer to being empirical. But the ones that I mentioned, the top four, you know, the Marxism, the postmodern critical theory bullshit, the victim theory feminist bullshit, and last but not least, the neoliberal Fukuyama bullshit. All four of these kind of have one thing in common. And in a sense, they're all kind of Marxist in a sense. You know, the whole thesis, antithesis, synthesis, or what is sometimes called problem action, problem, problem reaction solution. The one thing all of these kind of crappy historicist models have in common is either an overt, you know, which means explicit, which means in your face, or a covert or, you know, implicit or maybe under the surface or latent kind of revenge theory, which means that you can categorize, or I should say not categorize, but you could box up most of these historicist models under the general category of history as revenge. And I have to say, it could be a function of my darkness these days that, you know, it's not like I've ever been the most cheerful person at any one point in my life. At the happiest times in my life, I was probably always a little bit like Eeyore, you know, full disclosure. I've never really, since I was born, thought that I was born into a world of amazing progress and potential. Probably since I could begin thinking, I saw the cracks. So yeah, I've never really believed the bullshit, okay, at all. But yeah, you could, if you wanted to, group all of these kinds of terrible historicist theories into a general category called history as revenge. And what I mean by that is really quite simple. That if you want to get past the bullshit, you know, somehow navigate through the ideologies and all of the arcane terminology, the cis-Marxist crapola, the deconstructionist anal rectification, the quasi-hermeneutic, feminist, transcendentalist, whatever fucking neoliberal, you know, riprap. If you want to get through all of that and just cut right through it, you're really talking about various groups, insiders and outsiders. And the what I would say is the shift between people who are on the inside and people on the outside. And of course, I could add another category of historicist theories, and this is the one that involves secret societies and conspiracy as history, but I don't really want to talk about that necessarily in a direct way, but more in an indirect way. History as revenge might be a plan. Like, it could be the case that there's an evil cabal that's had many names throughout history, and it came into existence maybe right from the beginning, who knows. You know, some people claim that the secret societies are really just offshoots of those religious or priestly classes that learned enough about astronomy and enough about irrigation to sort of become really the first cargo prophets. And if you don't know what a cargo prophet is, let's talk about that for a second. A cargo prophet relates to an anthropological phenomenon from really World War II. During World War II, there were parts of the South Pacific that, for all intents and purposes, had never seen much, if anything, of modernity, of modern civilization. So when Americans showed up with their, you know, quick-built, landing strips and airports and their ports for ships and docks. And when they showed up with all their prefab crap and they started building these sort of weird communities on these islands, the natives were encountering for the first time what, you know, Arthur C. Clarke would describe as magic because the technology was so advanced. So when Arthur C. Clarke once said that any sufficiently advanced technology would look like magic to, you know, a less advanced society. Well, that's kind of what happened in the South Pacific during World War II when these various military bases were being set up. So yeah, you could argue if you go back 6,000 or 7,000 years that the first cargo prophets were really those priestly classes that kind of figured out enough to predict things like lunar eclipses and make good guesses about water flow and water usage. They basically learned enough about nature to basically pull the wool over people's eyes. And yes, I'm a religious person. I'm a Christian. But here's the thing. I'm a real Christian, which means I'm not a God squad Christian. I'm not going to tell you that I think, you know, everybody goes to heaven as long as they live an okay life. If you live an okay life, but you have no faith in Jesus, I'm sorry. According to my religion, you're going to hell. If you're a Buddhist, you're going to hell. If you're a Wiccan or somebody that worships Odin, I was reading an article about the Navy on naval ships, various religious groups that were pagan and heathens and worshiped, you know, Nordic gods. And listen, if you're doing that, you're going to hell. Sorry, you're going to hell. That's my belief system. I am not going to tell you that I am lukewarm on this one. I kind of like the way that it's referred to in Revelations. You know, Christ wants you hot or cold. He does not want you in between. So yes, I'm telling you the way it is from my perspective. There is no God squad. Jews and Muslims and Christians are not leading the way for everyone to go to heaven. That's not my belief. But that being said, it just makes me even more critical of cultish type religions. So yeah, there is this other historicism, which it could be categorized as number five, and that is history as conspiracy. But I don't really want to talk about that, because even if that's true, it really is an epistemic dilemma for me. I don't know how I determine the truth of it. I live in a situation where I am being fed truth through various means of control, and I just generally don't have the time or energy to know for sure or to find out or even to have a successful method for determining what's true. I can apply logic and observation. That is always available to me. But that's logic and observation about living in Little Saigon in Seattle, or in Dayton, Ohio, or Indianapolis, or any of the other places I've lived. I cannot speak to anything outside of that zone. So yes, if you wanted to take all of these weird historicist theories, you could call it history as revenge. And simply put, what I mean by this is the following. That throughout history, you have periods of time where a particular group, a culture, a class, a caste, an ethnicity, a group that identifies itself in one or more dimensions, religious dimensions, genetic or biological dimensions, superficial dimensions, like, hey, I'm white and you're black, stuff like that. And in general, you can call this the insider-outsider problem. The insiders are in charge. The outsiders are basically the peons and the serfs. And you can more or less think in terms of the resolution of a historical epic in terms of some sort of revenge spasm. So like the French Revolution. There are lots of people who look at it and say to themselves, well, you know, the French Revolution was this, or it was the Masons, or it was economically determined, or whatever. And depending upon how they see the world, they're going to tell you what happened. But what if it was really just about a bunch of people who were being treated miserably, badly, by the people in charge? So the outsiders are being beat up by the insiders. And at some point, if it's within the power of the outsiders, either in terms of numbers or resources or both, to sort of stand up for themselves, you get a revenge spasm. And that shit happens. And guess what? When it does happen, it's not rational. It's not based on any sense of universal justice. Arguably, if you're a religious person like me, you can see more of the devil at work in all this than anything else. I'm not claiming that people that stand up for themselves are satanic. Rather, just the opposite. I would prefer every single person listening to me right now to value their own sovereignty, even if they're not religious. I don't give a fuck if you're religious, but you should recognize the following, that you being a free human being, that you having choices, that you having dignity as a human being exists irrespective of what any fucking government says. I'm not saying governments can't kill you. They can kill you. Governments kill people all the fucking time. And it doesn't matter what the citizen believes. There are people, I'm going to lay on a little secret. It's not a secret. It's a bit rhetorical, sarcastical. But there are likely people in Iraq back in 2003. There were people living in Iraq who loved Americans and loved the United States. I'm not saying it's most Iraqis. I'm not even saying it's half, but there is a likelihood that we killed people during the Iraq War who actually liked America. So when it comes to violence and chaos and people doing these things, it's not about the perfection of justice, because there really is no justice in revenge. It is a cycle of hate. And that's why the revenge theory of history for me is interesting and powerful, because it more or less explains everything, and it never ends. It explains the revolution and the counter-revolution. It explains the reformation and the counter-reformation. It explains every spasm of revenge and how that spasm of revenge sets the world up 10, 20, maybe 100 fucking years later for another spasm of revenge. Let me digress once more. I was in my modern Western European history class. I forget the professor's name, but she always bragged about how she worked for how she worked in the Johnson administration and the Kennedy administration, and you know, she was a big time lefty, not really neoliberal, but basically Fukuyama freak. And this is 1990. So here's this woman, this older woman from the, you know, who was teaching as a professor, I think out of the Jackson School of International Studies at the UW. But she was essentially, as her first career, working the State Department. So totally believes in the United Nations, totally believes in the EU, totally believes Fukuyama's bullshit about the evolution of history towards these liberal democratic states. And this is 1990. And one of her examples of how history can be undone is Yugoslavia. Now, for all you kiddos out there, you millennials and Generation Z, you may not be aware that there was this country called Yugoslavia that never existed prior to 1919 and pretty much didn't exist after 1993. You know, it really didn't. So for a period of time, let's call it, I don't know, what's that, about 70 years, plus or minus, for about seven decades, this country called Yugoslavia existed. And this professor would talk about Yugoslavia like it's a good example of how history is powerful in its change, and how we don't ever have to worry about ethnic hatred, because look at Yugoslavia. It worked through all of its ethnic hatred issues. It no longer has a memory of this because of all the decades of Tito and other kinds of bullshit. And she went off about how, you know, Yugoslavia was a partial member of the European Union and the Sino-Soviet split, blah, blah, blah. And again, this is 1990, so this is only a couple years before shit started really falling apart in Yugoslavia. I mean, really fucking falling apart. So people believe this nonsense. I mean, in 1990, Germany was reunifying. If you saw the world through Fukuyama's eyes, it kind of looked like, holy shit, globalism's winning. The United States is the hero of the world, and everybody wants to just kind of be neoliberal and globalist and, you know, fuck you. But then a couple years later, you know, 1992, 93, this place that had overcome its ethnic hatreds and its revenge cycles started seeing lots of people getting killed, started seeing Serbs and Croats and Albanians, Muslims and Christians murdering each other. Now, according to this brilliant professor, who I don't know if she's still alive, I doubt she still teaches, because, I mean, she'd probably be in her 80s or almost 90s by now. But yeah, she might still teach there, because that's kind of how sclerotic modern academia is. Whole separate topic. But yeah, a couple years later, I didn't even see her those years. This was like my senior year at the University of Washington. A couple years later, shit was really falling apart in Yugoslavia. And, you know, back in 1990, when I was taking these courses, these seminar courses, I remember telling people, listen, I don't really believe the narrative. I don't think this is true. I know that Fukuyama appeals to people because it is essentially kind of that part of that mythology, which, you know, some people point to Henry Luce and that famous essay, The American Century, but it's part of that mythology about America being this essential country unfolding this sort of world history, the New World Order, as George Bush called it, you know, Herbert Walker Bush, the guy who's now dead, ex-CIA chief, amongst other things. People believe that shit. And then a couple years later, yeah, shit was starting to fall apart. Now, there are people who, again, believe in the conspiracy theory of history, and I'm not opposed to it. I just have no way of verifying it, really, who would say, well, these were secret societies who want disorder. And that could be true. But if I remove that theory off the table, all these other theories kind of fall into the same box. So fast forward to America today, and this obsession with, I don't know how many sexual predilections and positions, but there appear to be a nearly infinite number of genders and subgenders now. But the one thing everyone within the intelligentsia of America can agree with, the exceptional globalist New World Order bullshit artists, generally academic intelligentsia agrees on, is that the white man, the white male, the white straight male of history is the great enemy. And as long as that particular entity is destroyed, all will be okay. And I think I've said this in the past, none of this feels tragic to me in any personal sense. This kind of bullshit is no different than an earthquake or a plague. You know, people sometimes classify group madness as something special because, you know, it involves humans and it's not a plague. It's not a comet that hits the earth. But when people give in to groupthink, in some sense, they're giving in to the fundamental forces of nature. And the thing about the revenge theory of history is it totally feeds off that. I mean, humans and revenge, it's like, you know, bacon and eggs. It's like peanut butter and jelly. People carry grievances. In fact, some of the worst people for grievances are the ones that say they have none. And boy, could I talk on that issue for a while. So yeah, at this point, I kind of, and again, tongue in cheek, because in general, I'm critical of historicism, but tongue in cheek, if you really do want a general theory of history that more or less explains a lot of what's going on today and will continue to happen forever, because humans are just, it seems, completely incapable of learning, at least not as groups. As individuals, I think humans can be brilliant. It's why I believe in a free society. You know, as individuals making choices to cooperate, humans can be brilliant. As groups forcing human beings to obey, forcing them to conform, I think human society becomes incredibly stupid. So you have two choices. You have the choice between the free society that can react to events, that can make changes, because again, you're trusting millions or hundreds of millions of brains to make decisions, to process information in a distributed way. And in general, it is my opinion that this behavior is way more likely to produce positive outcomes than what we have today in America, or frankly, what we ever had in America, at least outside the frontier. You know, humans left to their own devices, all things being equal, in my opinion, will solve problems efficiently. And they'll do it in a way that is, truly anti-fragile, which means do it in a way where, yeah, you're always going to have disasters, you're always going to have chaos and things go wrong, but the entire system doesn't fail. America today is a daisy chain of bad ideas. So a failure here, a failure there, and all of a sudden the whole thing starts falling apart. And this general sense of seeking revenge, like I was at the train station a couple weeks ago, walking about 100 feet behind an African-American woman. I want to repeat that. I was 100 feet behind her. There were three people waiting for the train. She turns directly at me and starts yelling at me and calls me out as a white man. I was walking in Little Saigon last summer, and there was a young African-American woman in a car going with her friends. And I think that what she screamed at me was white bitch, which again, bitch is a pejorative term that is applied to both male and female. So yeah, just live with that one. Of all this, I still don't care. If you're going to tell me that I think that I'm being persecuted individually, I don't believe that's the case. I think there's a general madness. And the thing about crazy is you really can't reason with it. you also really can't spend a lot of time, I don't want to say blaming it, but you can't spend a lot of time blaming the people. You should defend yourself. If crazy, you know, if crazy comes at you with a knife, you need to defend yourself. If crazy comes at you with a gun, you should defend yourself. But don't attempt to reason with crazy, okay? Try to figure out a way to keep your head down. Try to figure out a way to educate and influence. But don't pretend you're going to sit down at the table with crazy. And this is what happens during a revenge spasm, where people are seeking revenge. They're really in a mentally deranged state. Don't expect you're going to sit down and say, hey, crazy dude, or crazy lady, or crazy human being, or it. I don't give a fuck what pronoun you want to be called. Probably why you hate me and why you're so fucking crazy. You're not going to sit down and have a conversation with crazy. It isn't going to happen. Crazy has to put their gun down or their knife down or their bat down. Crazy has to be willing to communicate. In fact, more importantly, crazy, whatever form that takes, whether it's the LGBTQRXY community or some sort of American socialist bullshit or a bunch of Latinos who want to say they have a right to steal my shit because I'm an evil white dude. Or maybe it's an African American who wants to say that somehow, even though there is no historical possibility that any of my relatives or ancestors had anything to do with slavery, that I need to write a giant check to them because of slavery. Whatever form crazy takes, don't expect to reason with it. Really don't. You know, you need to let crazy cool off. This is good advice because, again, I think this is silly. I don't believe there is a revenge theory of history because I think a lot of these historicist models are essentially flawed. And what's worse, they tend to act as rationalizations. Like, in my view, Marxism is very much a rationalization for violence. If you take seriously the words in the Communist Manifesto, and if you take seriously the words in Das Kapital, or any of the essays written by Karl Marx, and I even include the stuff he wrote in the 1840s, the so-called German essays, whatever you want to say about this, okay, that whether you want to talk about humanist Marx, which I don't know how the fuck you talk about that, or the really stark Marx, Marx and Marxism is a giant rubric, a giant justification for taking violence on other people, for murdering people. Antifa. I mean, look at Antifa today. Antifa is a perfect example of the revenge theory of history. You're not going to reason with these people, okay? You're not going to sit down and say, well, you know, wearing masks and dressing in black suits and co-opting symbols that look like anarchist symbols, but they actually aren't because you're fighting against human liberty. These are crazy things, and maybe you should back off, figure out what you want, what you believe, and try to convince people through, you know, influence, through speech, through words. That sounds great, but you're never going to do that. The Antifa crowd will block the road because those people, whatever their deformed beliefs might be, or whatever crappy ideology they've clung to, and it's probably in most cases some variant of Marxist, cultural Marxist, or neo-Marxist, feminist, Frankfurt School bullshit, whatever bullshit they've clung to, there is an underlying soil. It is the manure. And this is maybe how I should end this, because this is why you shouldn't try to reason with crazy, because you should try to understand where it comes from. People are often made crazy, okay? A few years ago, Janet Yellen, during the period of time when she was, excuse me, sarcastic air quotes, tapering the quantitative easing, she made the statement that the U.S. needs to run a high-pressure economy. And at the time, I thought to myself, I think I had read an article about a woman in New Jersey who had been working three jobs and had died of exhaustion. She was a working mom. So this high-pressure economy, this working mom who died essentially, you know, in a convenience store parking lot of exhaustion, she was already there. The Americans that are shooting up fentanyl and killing themselves left and right, they are already there, Janet, you stupid fuck. They are already in a high-pressure economy. They are already experiencing the executive monkey experiment, where the monkeys are shocked and shocked and shocked, And whether the monkey holds the lever or not, they're going to get shocked and eventually they die. Nobody needs to run that experiment if they understand the parameters. They know that eventually the monkey's going to have a heart attack, a stroke, and die. So when you talk about these deformed ideologies, it's true that these things are symptoms. Like these, or I won't even say symptoms. These are essentially, it's kind of like in chemistry when you have molecules or elements that can bond with each other based upon their structure, you know, based upon whether they're slightly negatively charged, slightly positively charged, can they exchange electrons, blah, blah, blah. I'm not a chemist. But the point is, there are features of atoms and molecules that allow atoms and molecules to bond. And Marxism, and you know, my favorite band Rush in their song Free Will deals with this. Marxism is one of those philosophies that bonds really well with grievances. This doesn't mean the grievances are wrong. I think Americans are being boiled alive by a central banking system that is fundamentally corrupt. It benefits very few people at the top. It is crony. It is not free enterprise. I will repeat that statement because I think people are that fucking stupid now or crazy. It is not free enterprise. What we practice in America is a slightly tuned up version of central planning. And while it's not the case that the Federal Reserve tells us how many tractors we're going to build next year, every time they manipulate the money supply, they are basically telling us how much economic growth we're going to have next year. That is basically true. You know, and I don't think anybody should be in that business. I think it's a terrible business. It is a dysfunctional business. And in the last 20 or 30 years, and basically my whole adult life, the business of central bankers has destroyed the middle class. So you have a lot of people out there between the ages of, let's say, 18 and 50 or 40 or whatever, who are really pissed off. They have valid reasons to be pissed off. And then some Marxist comes along and says, well, you know, man, you have a right to be pissed off because you live in a capitalist system and, you know, currently you're one of the proletariat and the ruling class takes advantage of your work and your labor is a product of, you know, some formulas that can tell you that historically you need to throw off the chains of the ruling class and take over the means of production. And I could spit out a lot of really terrible Marxist bullshit. And because you have grievances, which are valid grievances, okay? Valid fucking concerns, grievances, and angers and anxieties, you cling on to this. And so you end up with shit like Antifa. And on top of that, you have fuckers like George Soros and frankly, our own government that funds non-governmental organizations, that uses, in many cases, money, okay, taxpayer dollars in one form or another, to fund people to go to these protests. So you have not only really terrible ideologies taking advantage of people's grievances and revenge, but then you have these terrible organizations taking advantage of people's basic poverty. They need the money, okay? I currently have no money. I'm not just exaggerating. I have $2 in my account at my credit union. Not proud, not ashamed, simply stating fucking facts. Now, do I blame anyone else for this but myself? No, not really. Do I wish we didn't have a central banking system? Yes. Do I wish I'd known this in my 20s? I think I would be in better shape today if I had truly been willing to just break free of the lie in my 20s and take my destiny into my own hands, whatever's left. But by the same token, there's not a lot of freedom left in this country. So if you decide to take your own destiny into your own hands in the United States of America in 2019, be fucking careful, because pretty much everybody's a criminal at this point. You don't even know if you're not a criminal, okay? There are so many laws, so many regulations, so many ways to fuck people in America today that pretty much everyone walking around is a criminal in waiting, depending upon what the powers that be want to do. So that's the thing. That's the way I want to end this podcast, is that, yes, the revenge theory of history is kind of silly. But what's not so silly about it is the way in which people's legitimate pain and anger is taken advantage of. And throughout history, this has happened. Julius Caesar started out, well, he didn't start out this way, but one of his steps along the road of becoming a dictator, which is an actual role in the Roman government. In Roman government, you could pick someone to be dictator. During the Second Punic War, and probably during the First, but I know during the Second, there were people, especially during the Siege of Rome by Hannibal, there was a person, and there have been people chosen to be dictator. Dictator was a role. So anyways, on the road to becoming the legal dictator of Rome, Julius Caesar, I believe, was tribune of the people. And tribune of the people is kind of like saying it was a legal political role in Roman society. And let's be blunt about what that means. Even up to Caesar's time, Roman society meant mainly citizens of Rome, which mainly meant the principalities of Rome, which didn't even include all of what we would call Italy today. It was really just the Roman city-state, even at that point, for the most part. Not completely, it was changing. But one of the great defects, and I say defects, of Roman civilization was this fact that even towards the end of the Roman Empire in the West, the Romans had a hard time expanding citizenship. Don't want to go into that too much depth, but that's just one of the features of Roman history. So yeah, Julius Caesar, during his along the road to becoming dictator of Rome, was tribune of the people at one point. And being tribune of the people really means being a demagogue, being someone who services the venal needs and desires, hatreds, passions, you name it, all of the stuff that doesn't involve reason and logic. The tribune of the people would serve those interests. And Julius Caesar, being a brilliant politician, took advantage of those things. He took advantage of the insider-outsider phenomena. In fact, in some ways, Julius Caesar understood the revenge theory of history, and that's very much a part of Roman culture, by the way, which America does a great job of emulating in our own society. That whole revenge thing, like the concept of proscription, it was actually a thing in Roman society where if a party took control of the Senate, that party would carry out revenge, would carry out proscription, would carry out theft and murder from their political enemies. So yeah, the more I think about it, the revenge theory of history may be closer to the truth. And I don't want to go off into, you know, Nietzsche and philosophy and whatnot, but there's probably more to it than just a joke. What I believe is not controversial, and it's related to a paper that Professor Davies, I believe from UCLA, maybe Berkeley, 1962, Toward a Theory of Revolution. Davies' paper basically contends that if you want to understand revolution or civil war or any type of insurrection or social chaos, you need to understand the difference between what people expect and what people have. Okay? As long as expectations and reality more or less match, according to Davies, you have stability. So if you have a historically poor society that remains historically poor, even if it is historically poor, for the most part, as long as there aren't any really big changes, you'll probably be fine. If you have a historically rich society and it stays kind of stable and rich, you'll probably be fine. But if you have a society, according to Davies, that goes through a rapid period of growth, and then all of a sudden there's a setback, it's irrelevant if the setback is still a higher point than, let's say, your grandparents, your great-grandparents. So this gets back to the whole, well, gee, would you want to live like your great-grandparents? Well, people don't think that way. They think in terms of their lives. And if they're staring down a cliff and they're looking behind them and all they see is cliff, and in front of them all they see is cliff, they don't want to fucking hear that they're still higher than the valley on the other side of the fucking mountain. That doesn't help them as they're, you know, living off of food stamps for their kids. It really doesn't. That rationalization doesn't work according to Davies. According to Davies, it's when societies experience this, whether it was Egypt during the 80s and 90s, whether it was the French middle class during the 18th century, or frankly, whether it's China today, which experienced a tremendous amount of growth in the last 30 years economically, and is probably heading for a setback, these are the points of true instability. But why? It's because of these grievances. It's because of the anger. It's because of the hatred and the pain. And none of these things are rational, but they're all very, very real. If you walk around Seattle today, and I don't care who you are, you might be white, you might be black, you might be gay, you might be straight, I really don't give a fuck. If you walk around Seattle today, and you won't have to walk that far, you could choose to walk every day of the week, 2 miles, but in different directions, you're going to see a lot of angry people, but they're not all angry for the same reason, okay? And they're all going to have explanations for how to save everybody. What I would contend, and what I would bet, is that no matter who you talk to, they will bring up a group of people who they believe is to blame. So if it's a traditional Democrat in Seattle, well, it's a fucking Republicans. And if it's a Republican in, I don't know, Magnolia or on the East Side, they'll say it's a fucking Democrats. If it's a socialist, they'll say it's the fascists. If it's a fascist, they'll say it's the socialist. This is the thing. You'll find an object of their hatred. It isn't just that they're in pain. They are in pain. It's not just that they're poor. In many cases, they are extremely poor. It's not just because they're homeless. They're homeless. It sucks to be homeless. But it's also that in addition to all of their anxiety and pain and deprivation, they have a target. They have the pain and they have the sadness. They have the anger. They have all of the real, quantifiable, physical features of being on the edge and falling off the edge and their lives falling apart. But on top of all of this negative crap that's happened to them, they have a target. They have somebody they blame. You know, they've been blame-storming with their friends and they know who is to blame. So yes, when I look at America today and I ask myself that question, I think in terms of this rather simplistic revenge theory of history, I think maybe the best course of action for someone like myself is to keep my head down until this fucking storm of chaos blows over. I mean, eventually, and I think this is the good news, though some people won't get it that it is good news. Eventually, if shit really does fall apart, people will be too busy trying to find food and water and shelter to care much about fucking politics. So maybe the silver lining in all of this is that if we're lucky and our society falls apart fast enough, we might just not have the time or energy or inclination to seek revenge. But I gotta say, I don't know if that's the case. You know, there's a lot of talk these days about a second American Civil War. But what most Americans don't get is that the first American Civil War was not like a traditional civil war. The concept of civil war, at least in Western civilization, mostly comes from ancient Rome. And civil war in ancient Rome wasn't about a southern Rome and a northern Rome. It was mostly about different sects, different groups, different classes with different levels of resources seeking large-scale revenge and resource extraction and wealth stealing. During the Roman Civil Wars, you were talking about patricians, which was basically the upper class in Rome, patricians choosing sides, funding armies and generals, and fighting each other. But it was much more chaotic. Truly in Rome itself, it was very chaotic. So if you were to ask yourself which civil war was more like a traditional civil war, the American Civil War, where you had actual armies, actual generals, actual uniforms, lines of battle. I mean, you had dual governments. The American Civil War, for good or for bad, was way more like two nations at war than it was a traditional civil war. And then you have Yugoslavia. And Yugoslavia and what happened there in the 90s is way more like what a real civil war is like. Okay? Real civil wars, when they happen, you walk down the street any direction and you may encounter an enemy. During a real civil war, when it happens, you don't know friend from enemy. There are no real uniforms that will help you, okay? The Romans that fought each other during the Roman Civil Wars, those legions were dressed the same. They had the same uniforms. They had the same weapons. It was basically a lot of chaos large scale and small scale, like Yugoslavia. If another civil war, quote unquote, happens in the U.S., in my opinion, it's going to be way more like Yugoslavia than the 1860s, okay? It's not going to be gray versus blue with these perfectly defined lines. It'll be more like you walk down the street any direction, you have no fucking clue who your friend is, your ally is, your enemy is. You don't have a clue. So yes, the revenge theory of history. I'm not sure it's original, of which I don't care. I'm not sure it's accurate, because this is meant to be just, you know, kind of a thought experiment slash hypothetical, counterfactual, whatever. I kind of expect you to go on this strange journey and ask yourself questions, but you don't have to ever agree with me. But yeah, I think the revenge theory of history accurately covers a lot. It does cover this essential desire on the part of a lot of people for instant justice. You know, people, and this includes me, okay? I try to overcome it, and I think in general I do, but people, my own family is at the point where they can barely talk to each other, different parts of it, about anything real, because immediately it becomes us versus them. And that's a family, okay? And I'm not saying my family's a perfect family, it's not. But it's about as, you know, sort of center of mass normal as most families are. I talk to a lot of people with big families these days, and they'll tell me the same thing. Brothers and sisters, moms and dads, cousins, aunts and uncles, they're not talking to each other. Friendships are ending, okay? Friendships where people stood up for each other for decades are disappearing. And then add to this that people are simply dropping off the social radar because they're becoming poor to the point of oblivion. And yeah, you've got a nice bouillabaisse for something that looks a lot more like Yugoslavia. And that should give you pause. That you should sort of think about that on this Wednesday afternoon.